Our theme this morning is living for Christ, and it turns out that in the economy of God, in the ordering of God, pain has a strange and mysterious and yet very important role in our learning to live, to be the people that God always intended us to be from before the foundation of the world. And I haven't had opportunity to talk to all of you, of course, but I have talked to quite a number, and it's surprising, or not surprising really, how often the theme of some really painful or hard situation has come out. So as I guessed yesterday, amongst you there's a great deal of pain. And so I thought it'd be good to begin by reminding you of the comforting words of Peter on this subject, 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 12 and 13. Dear friends, that's us, dear friends, don't be surprised at the painful trial you're suffering, as though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 12 and 13. Go back to that often when you find yourself locked into some hard situation quite beyond your control, which is particularly painful to you because you're a Christian. Go back to it often and remind yourself that there's nothing strange about a Christian feeling pain. In fact, it's our calling. Let's remind ourselves of what we read in Philippians chapter 1 yesterday, verse 29. Paul's word to his friends who were going through the same kind of struggles that he was. And we know a little bit about his struggles. For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for him. See, we can't have one without the other. It's like love and marriage, or horses and carriages. You can't have one without the other, they say. You can't be a Christian and not have pain. That's the reality. And we need to face up to that fact and not be downcast by it, because that isn't the end of the story, as we read yesterday. And then finally, another comforting word, this time from the Lord himself, in John chapter 16, verse 33. I have told you these things, and we're going to, a little bit later, go back to some of these things. I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. Our peace is to be found in him. So that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. And I find it absolutely fascinating to realise that that word trouble is the same word that Jesus uses earlier in this chapter, speaking of the pain of labour. In this world you're going to have the pain of labour. And of course the pain of labour is not meaningless pain, it's purposeful pain. It doesn't make it any less painful, of course, but the reality is that the pain that we're going to suffer as Christians in this world is not meaningless pain, it is not purposeless pain, it is purposeful. In this world you will have trouble, you will have labour pain, said Jesus, but take heart, I have overcome the world. The victory has been won. We simply have to work it out in our own experience. And Nancy and I were talking before the meeting began about the false teaching that there is around about pain, that there's something somehow wrong in a Christian feeling pain. That's totally unbiblical, absolute rubbish, not to put too fine a point on it. It is our vocation. And it comes back to the question, what are we going to do with the painful things that happen to us? And yesterday, as we thought about Philippians chapter 1, We saw Paul's example, and I suppose the key verse in that second part of the chapter that we considered yesterday is in verse 19 when he says, "What has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance," and recognising the fact that what Paul was saying there was that the hard thing that had happened to him had in reality, and he expected that it would more and more, broken through barriers in his own perception of God. See, none of us have arrived in our perception of God, and we get ourselves into difficulties when we think we have arrived. This is the sort of attitude that makes us look at another Christian and say, "Oh, well, he or she's wrong. They're off the track. They don't believe what I believe. They're off the track." But the reality is that even in our perception, even in our concept of God, we haven't arrived. And Paul hadn't either. And Paul is saying to us in this passage that the hard thing, the painful thing, the inexplicable thing in human terms that had happened to me, being cut off at the height of a fruitful ministry, in reality turned out to be something marvellous, because it was the pain that prodded me through to an even wider and more marvellous understanding of what God is like. And out of that flowed a ministry such as he had not had before. And we read about the advance of the gospel that happened as a result of that. And then we saw that Paul, in this breakthrough in his mind, in his spirit, in his concept of God, he'd come through to the point of being able to say, and mean it, "For me, to live is Christ. To die is gain." And Ruth and I were struck in reading Wiersbe's little book on Philippians with something that he says there. He suggests to us the little exercise of crossing out Christ and gain and writing it out for ourselves. "For me to live is..." blank, you fill in the blank, and then "to die is blank," and you fill in the blank. And what if "for me to live is my family"? What if that's the fills in the blank? "To die is what?" Beg your pardon?
Separation.
Separation, loss. Okay? What if "for me to live is physical health"? "To die is loss," obviously. I mean, that's the final loss as far as physical health is concerned. What about if "for me to live is achievement, some kind of achievement"? Then "to die is disappointment, loss." It's a very interesting little exercise to ask myself, well, really, what does "for me" fit into that blank? "For me to live is..." And it's marvellously encouraging to see that Paul, in his progress through life, recognising that life is all about being transformed more and more into the image of his Son, until that marvellous moment when we see him face to face, and as John tells us, we're going to be like him. And we can't even begin to understand that. But in Paul's progress through to that point, he had actually reached the stage where he could say, "For me to live is simply Christ." And because he had that attitude, then death wasn't the big deal that it is for so many of us. Death wasn't the thing to be frightened of, either in those close to us or in ourselves. Because "for me," said Paul, "to live is Christ." And it's very interesting to look at another example that Paul gave of really overwhelming pain in his life. And you might like to turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 8 and following. Paul, in this little passage, again, it's absolutely fascinating. Why does Paul keep writing to people about the hard things that happened to him? Now, that's an interesting question. We read yesterday of him writing to the Philippians, "I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me, the hard thing that's happened to me, has etc., etc." Here he's writing to the Corinthians, and he's putting it in a slightly different way. Verse 8, "We don't want you to be uninformed, brothers. We want you to know, brothers, about the hardships we suffered in the province of Asia." He doesn't tell us what the hardships were, and again, I think the reason is that we will grab hold of the principle and apply it to our own particular hardships, hard situations. "We don't want you to be uninformed, brothers, about the hardships we suffered in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure," says Paul. So if you feel you're in a situation that's far beyond your ability to endure at this moment, you are in excellent company. You're in the company of no less a person than Paul. And how did Paul feel? He says, "We despaired even of life." That's how Paul felt. Deeply depressed and even suicidal. "We despaired even of life." And in case we get the message wrong, "Indeed, in our hearts we felt the sentence of death." Ever felt the sentence of death in your heart? Well, Paul's been there. And so let's read on with great anticipation to see what he's going to tell us about this experience of his, because we know he came through it, and that in itself is something to give us great heart, great encouragement, great hope. Looking back on it, Paul says, "But this happened." Why did this happen? See, when these things happen to us, we ask, why? Why is this happening to me? Lord, you know that my desire is to serve you. Why have you got me locked into this situation where it seems that I can't? Why is this happening? Why are you doing this to me or to this person whom I love? Why? What's life all about anyway? And I venture to suggest that Paul was saying the same thing, because we see him answering that question. "But this happened that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God." And how does he describe God? "God who raises the dead." Isn't that marvellous that Paul had to, in a sense, go through this experience where he felt like death? He felt the sentence of death in his heart. And looking back on it, he could say, "I know why this happened, because I discovered that God is the one who raises the dead. God had to work in my situation. I was pushed right beyond the end of my tether. And what did I discover? I discovered that God was there." I read a story in the Sydney Morning Herald a number of years ago about an American oil magnate who taught his son about trust in this way, that he put the little fellow on top of a wall about 4 feet high, he was only little, and he said to his son, "Now jump." And the little boy said, "But Daddy, if I jump, I'll hurt myself." And he said, "No, you won't. I'm here and I'll catch you." And so the little fella jumped. And just as he got to the place where his father's arms were, his father stepped back and let him fall on the ground. And when the little fella had stopped crying, he said to his dad, "Daddy, why did you do that?" And he said, "Because you've got to learn that in this world you can trust nobody." Now, I've often wondered, that's a true story, I've often wondered what happened to that little boy, what kind of man he grew up to be. Well, Paul's experience is quite different from that. He said, "When I went over my wall, I found that my father's arms were there. And he grabbed me, and I discovered that he is the one who rescues us. He's the one who raises the dead when we've got the sentence of death in our hearts. And then he goes on to say, he has delivered us from such a deadly peril, and he will deliver us. On him we've set our hope that he will continue to deliver us. I discovered in that painful situation something more about God, something absolutely marvellous. Again, echoing Job's words of what he discovered about God. Job asked many, many questions when he was in his pain. And how many answers did he get to his questions? Absolutely none. None. And then God asked Job some questions of his own. And the questions that God asked Job were, number one, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Now that's a great perspective restorer, don't you think? Because what pain does to us is to lock us into our little worlds. We know that with physical pain, that when we're in severe physical pain, we don't care what's happening about the economy or what's happening in the Middle East or anything like that, or even what's happening to our family, probably, if the pain's severe enough. All we care about is getting relief from our pain. And so God said to Job, while Job was in the middle of his pain, Job, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? You're overwhelmed by your pain, but it's just a tiny fragment of reality. And I have it all in control. But the second question you might identify with more than that, the second was, Job, are you more just than I am? Is your idea of what's fair better than mine? That's a good one to ponder when we're saying to the Lord, this isn't fair. This situation that I'm in is not fair. By human standards, it isn't fair. But we're not talking about human standards. We're talking about the fact that this world is only a tiny fraction of reality. It's just a little forerunner of the marvellous things that are ahead. And we can't even begin to conceive of the things that are ahead. So pain makes us ask questions, and God very often doesn't answer our questions. But that's not the end of the story. The end of the story is that God intervenes in our situation and reveals himself to us in a way that we never knew about before. And as a result of that, we're new people, we're different people. Things will never be the same again. Of course they won't. That person can't be brought back. That person whom I dearly loved can't be brought back. The situation that I'm in can't be reversed. I made certain choices and I'm in this situation. But that's not the end of the story. God has something better, something different, something new, something far more wonderful than I had ever had any idea of before. And at the beginning of this chapter, Paul talks, we're still on 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Paul talks a little bit about the outcome of what he learned as a result of going beyond the end of his tether and finding the loving arms of God there. As a result of this, says Paul, verses 4 and following, or 3 and following, praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. I've learnt that he's the Father of compassion. He's the God of all comfort. Not only is he the God who raises the dead, but he's the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort. And that word comfort means standing beside to encourage. He's the one who comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves have received from God. See, we can only give to others in authentic ministry what we've received from the Lord. And this is another very important thing to understand about our pain. It's as we get to know God more in our pain that we have something to give to other people who are in pain, so that we can say that our pain equips us, in a sense, to be healers. And that's one thing that we can dimly hang on to when the pain is on, that God if I respond appropriately to this, God is going to take this and use it in the fellowship of his sufferings, in the healing ministry, in the world. That's what the healing ministry boils down to. That's what it's all about. He comforts us so that we can become comforters in any trouble with the comfort that we ourselves have received from God. And this applies not only to comfort, it applies to things like forgiveness. You know that if somebody says, oh, I could never forgive that person, that the person who said that has a very poor understanding of the forgiveness of God. Because as I can get hold more and more of what I have been forgiven and of what it cost God, then that flows out in forgiveness to others. It has to. And so it is, whatever the particular kind of ministry it is that we're talking about. Who comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves have received from God. Just as the sufferings of Christ flow over into our lives, and this is part of the privilege that Paul talks about, the sufferings of Christ. I mean, we want to be made like him. We want to be identified with him. That means being identified with him in his death. That means being identified with him in his pain, his suffering. And that's privilege, says Paul. And again, it's not the end of the story. Beyond that is new life, resurrection. Just as the sufferings of Christ flow over into our lives, and when our pain is at its worst, it seems to fill every nook and cranny of our lives, so also through Christ our comfort overflows. Now, that is an enormously comforting and encouraging word. You may be sitting there thinking, oh, well, that's all very well, but the pain is still there. It's just as bad. And I don't experience this comfort. No, it's something slowly, slowly coming to us as we make it our aim to know him, our first aim to know him. And so then Paul goes on to say, if we are distressed, it is for your comfort. So he's really saying, I have come to understand that the pain that I have gone through is able to be used in ministry. And he comes through to the point of saying, I can see that my pain is for your comfort. And of course Paul had really had many barriers broken through in his spirit because he'd suffered so much. And a number of years ago, before I went to Papua New Guinea, I was confused because that clock says 9 o'clock, but everything's all right. Before I went to Papua New Guinea, when I was working in the labour ward of a hospital, a woman came in strong labour, and I wanted to give her an injection for her pain. And she said, no, don't give it to me. Pain and I are old friends. Pain and I are old friends. And I don't suppose I'd know that woman if I met her again. Maybe she's here today. If you're here today, stand up. Because I've wanted to meet her again. She had such an influence on my life. Just by those few words, Payne and I are old friends. And until that point, I think I'd thought of Payne as the enemy. But she started me thinking differently about pain. And I want to share with you some of the things that I now see looking back, like Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Looking back, I can see that this happened that. And one of them was, before I was converted, the pain of not belonging to God, of feeling that restlessness, that dissatisfaction, and not being able to put my finger on it and not knowing why. And other people saying, well, you just need to become a Christian. The things I was telling you yesterday. And then the pain of that and the pain of the search for God. And then coming through to the point of being convinced that God was there. It was the pain that drove me to that search. And so in that sense, that pain was a friend. Of course it was. I could have tried to blot it out, like many people do, trying all kinds of things like drugs or sexual promiscuity or all these things that people try to use to blot out the pain. The people in our generation are looking for some kind of aspirin to block out the pain, not recognising that the pain has a purpose, the purpose to drive us to God. And when we find him, then we can look back and say, of course, it was worth it all. And number two thing for me, the pain of doing medicine. What drove me to keep on with doing medicine? Because at the other side I could see, I believe that God had called me to be a missionary, a medical missionary. And so I persevered in that painful situation. And having graduated and actually worked as a doctor, as I told you yesterday, something marvellous happened. I discovered that I loved medicine. I would never have become a doctor if I hadn't become a Christian. And that pain, that painful experience, was in a sense necessary for me to come through to the point of understanding that God always wanted me to be a doctor anyway. And then as a missionary, the pain of being misunderstood. And we didn't talk about many of the hard things that happened to us yesterday, but there were plenty of them. It's hard to see the funny side of the hard things, especially at the time, and our job was to keep you awake. But this morning you seem to be fairly awake, so I'll press on. But you know, I had a terrible time because of standards, medical standards. As far as I'm concerned, it's always been that I don't care who the person is, if they're sick and if it's our job to look after them, then we give them the very best that we can give them with the resources available. And so I got into all kinds of trouble because I was said to be killing the nurses. I was killing myself too, incidentally. But the patients were there, and they are our responsibility. And as I saw it, it was our job to give them the very best that we could give them. And there was a fair bit of misunderstanding of that position. And that was very painful from my point of view. But you know, that turned out, that pain drove me to God in a way that very few other things had done. And why? Well, it was the same process. Being pushed beyond the end of your tether, going over your wall. You can't help yourself when you've gone over the wall. And finding God's arms there. And breaking through to a knowledge of God that you didn't have before. And out of that, flowing the kind of ministry that wasn't there before. Another little example, the pain of re-entry. It's funny, as we were talking about yesterday, you think, oh, it's my own country, I'm going back to my own country. And whenever I was on leave, I loved it. I loved deputation, loved seeing my friends again, loved being part of the church again, hearing the organ. I did so miss the organ music as a missionary. And all those things. And so when I came back permanently, I thought, oh, this is going to be great. And it was, initially. But then after a few months, I noticed that I was getting really angry with people and upset and depressed and blaming people. Being the kind of person I didn't know. I didn't know this person. I'd never been like this before. And it wasn't until I went to a seminar on counselling people who are bereaved that I understood what was happening to me, that I was grieving over everything that was there. But not only that, I recognised to my great shame that I was grieving over what might have been if I'd never...
Would you please turn the tape over at this point?
But not only that, I recognised to my great shame that I was grieving over what might have been if I'd never gone. That was a really hard one to face up to. You see, I saw my friends, my colleagues, they were professors of obstetrics and this kind of thing, and with a good contribution in our community. It wasn't their money or their possessions that worried me. It was the fact that they had something to contribute in our community. And what did I have? I mean, I was an expert on treating snake bite and malaria, things of that kind, but totally out of touch with heart disease and the latest technology and these kinds of things. They had something to contribute, but what was my role? In Papua New Guinea, I'd been a team leader and had to worry about all kinds of things, and I used to think to myself, oh, if only I could get a rest from this, I'd be right. But I wasn't. There I was, a non-contributor. And I'm sure that you don't have to be a missionary to identify with that. All your children have gone, and here you are. Empty nest syndrome, they call it. I call it the missionary emptiness syndrome that I was experiencing. The pain of re-entry. Okay, so what was to be done with that pain? Well, as a result of that pain, a ministry developing to people in the same kind of situation. Not being crushed by those chainsaws and bulldozers and dynamite that we talked about yesterday, but using them to break through into new areas. You see, both Ruth and I, because of all the 40 years between us, can you imagine such a thing? 40 years of missionary service between us, we ought to have discovered something to help people who are going through the pain that missionaries go through, whether it's the pain of re-entry or whatever. So the pain of re-entry drove me to look for a ministry using that pain. And this is the kind of thing that we're talking about, and this is an enormous part of what life, the Christian life, is all about. Another thing I noticed, I love obstetrics, that's why I keep using obstetric examples. Another thing that occurred to me as I was sitting beside someone in labour one day was that in obstetrics, we're very familiar with the concept of good and not so good pain. And the good pain is the painful pain. And the painful pain accomplishes something. That's why we say it's a good pain, you see. How's she getting on? The pains aren't very good. Well, that's bad news, because the baby's not being got out in the way that God always intended from before the foundation of the world. I don't know whether any of you in your second stage of labour have heard anyone say to you, don't waste your pain. Anyone heard that? Yeah. All the other people were really cooperative patients who didn't need to be told that. But we know that when the pain is on, we can cooperate with it and we can push. And the reason I say we is not the royal plural, but it's extraordinary how much the staff push with the patient. Push! Push! Or, in the second stage of labour, you can decide, I'm not going to have this baby. A number of people decide that. But there's a certain inevitability about it. But the trouble is that if you decide you're not going to have it, then the whole thing is greatly prolonged. And it may not be to the advantage of the baby. From the baby's point of view, the sooner you can cooperate with that pain and get it out, the sooner that marvellous moment's going to come when you hear that baby cry and you see that baby's face, and there's that special kind of joy that nothing else can quite equal. Okay, so There's a lesson in that for us. And Jesus used that example. In John chapter 16, he used that very example, talking about joy. And now we're getting on to Philippians chapter 3. And I have divided the first 16 verses into four aspects of letting our pain teach us more and more of living for Christ. This is what I think this chapter is about. And Paul talking about four aspects of this. And the first one that he talks about is joy in verse 1. And the second one he talks about is correcting our wrong thinking. These are aspects of living for Christ, correcting our wrong thinking, recognising and correcting it. The third is making knowing him our first priority in life. And the fourth is not giving up, however things may seem. Joy. Verse 1. Finally, my brothers, rejoice in the Lord. And what Paul is saying here is, keep on rejoicing. Keep on rejoicing, come what may. Now, what is he saying here? Is he saying that we need to go through life with a fixed smile on our face, contrary to all reasons for doing so? I suggest not. If we look at the life of the Lord Jesus, we read, he wept, he got angry. Facing the cross, he experienced deep troubling of his spirit and so on. Jesus did not go through the world with a fixed smile on his face. He certainly didn't face the cross with a fixed smile on his face. So what is Paul talking about here? Well, we're going back very quickly to that chapter in John 16, and I suspect that a number of you have already heard me on this subject, and if you have, I don't care, because it's absolutely marvellous concept. It bears repeating, and I know that only 20% of what is spoken is retained, so here's the other 80%, folks. Jesus, I find this absolutely marvellous. Because even though I've got a good sense of humour and smile a bit, I do get upset. I also get upset at times, folks. I feel distinctly short on joy, often. And there was a time when this used to make me feel quite guilty, until I really understood what Jesus was saying in this chapter to the disciples about joy. He was about to go, and he said, verse 20, I tell you the truth, you will weep and mourn while the world rejoices. You will grieve, but your grief will turn to joy. And I think that's enormously important, that we understand that joy is the outcome of pain, not a substitute for it. And we understand that perfectly well from our experiences with labour, your personal experience, my vicarious experience, multiplied by thousands. I've been there thousands of times, folks. I've experienced it up to a point. And I know that little baby that you look at and that gives you so much joy to see is, in a sense, the product of that pain. Agreed? It's not a substitute for that pain. It's the product of that pain. So that when you see that baby's face, you can say, after a little while, well, it was worth it all. I'm so glad that I had that experience of labour. Can you say that? I'm glad I had that experience of labour. Anyone here who could say that? That taught me something. I'll never be the same again, right? I'll never be the same again because I had that experience. And furthermore, I don't want it again. But no, that's not quite it. There's something more there. There was something special about that experience. I went through all that pain. And as a result, here's this baby. And my husband might be bonded to that baby. But sadly, he missed out on that pain. Do you understand a little bit of what I'm saying? Okay. So Jesus said, you'll grieve, you're going to grieve because I'm going. And then in the next verse, or in verse 22, he says, now is your time of grief in this world. Our time in this world is our time of grief, our time of pain. But it's not meaningless pain. And the face that we're going to see at the end of that pain is the face of the Lord Jesus himself. And then, more than ever before, we're going to be able to say, it was worth it all. A woman giving birth to a child has pain because her time has come. That's why. But when her baby is born, and these are Jesus' words, she forgets the anguish because of her joy that a child is born into the world. So with you, now is your time of grief, but I will see you again, and you will rejoice, and no one will take away your joy. See, now in this world, we're feeling just a tiny little bit of this anticipatory joy because we know the moment's going to come when we see Jesus' face and there's going to be fullness of joy. Just as when you're in the middle of your labour and the pain's awful, somewhere deep down, very deep down, you can say to yourself, but the moment is going to come when the baby's going to be born and it's going to be our baby. Isn't that a miracle? Even in the midst of the pain, you can say that to yourself. You mightn't be feeling anything much. You might be feeling awful. But anticipatory joy is not necessarily something we feel. It's something that we know is up ahead. Now is your time of grief, but I'll see you again and you'll rejoice and no one's going to take away that joy. In that day you will no longer ask me anything. Yes, we're going to get unquestionable answers to our present unanswerable questions. Derek Kidner, one of my greatest friends, Derek Kidner, I commend him to you. All his commentaries, everything is written. In that day, we're going to get unquestionable answers to our present unanswerable questions. In the meantime, doesn't matter, because we know we're going to get them then. In the meantime, we just press on, knowing that now is our time of pain. But there's going to come a time when we see his face and we'll know it was worth it all. Okay, so that is what Paul is talking about. That is what Paul means when he says, keep on rejoicing, brothers. I know you're in pain. Keep on rejoicing. Jesus, for the joy set before him, endured the cross. You and I, for the joy set before us, endure whatever it is that we're enduring at the moment. Okay. Keep on rejoicing, come what may. How can I rejoice when everything's so awful? I can rejoice by reminding myself of what's ahead. Anticipatory joy. That is what Paul is talking about. It's no trouble to me to write the same things to you again. I don't mind repeating it, says Paul. And it's a safeguard for you. That's joy. Number two, recognising and correcting wrong thinking. Verse 2, watch out for those dogs, those men who do evil, those mutilators of the flesh, for it is we who are the circumcision, we who worship by the Spirit of God, who glory in Christ Jesus and who put no confidence in the flesh. What on earth has that got to do with wrong thinking? Well, bear with me and we'll get there. Watch out. The words mean keep a close lookout for in order to avoid. What is it that he's telling them to avoid? As I understand it, he's telling them to avoid the suggestion that anything could or should be added to the gospel to make it more effective. In this case, he's talking about circumcision, because the Judaizers were saying, in order to be saved, you've not only got to believe in the Lord, but you've got to be circumcised. And he's using two Greek words here, which both mean cutting the flesh. One means circumcision, the other means castration. And when he's talking about mutilators of the flesh, that's what he's meaning. And so what he's saying, in effect, is that you, Jews, claim to make people right with God through circumcision. In reality, you're making them impotent, spiritually speaking. You're mutilating the message, you're mutilating their spiritual lives by telling them that anything has to be added to the gospel. Now, we might say, well, that's interesting, but it's not relevant to me because I don't add anything to the gospel. Well, now, just a moment. You might be like me. I once wrote to Ruth in a letter. We wrote often to one another when she was in Africa and I was in Papua New Guinea. And I said to her, I perceive in myself that in my behaviour I'm acting as if I believe in justification by works. You say to me, do you believe in justification by faith? I'd say, definitely. I certainly believe that I am saved by faith in Jesus Christ alone. And yet, I perceived in myself, when I did something that I thought was good, perhaps, I perceived in myself the kind of idea that by doing this, I'm somehow or other getting a little bit of extra credit with God. Ever had that feeling? I perceived it in myself, and I recognised this is purely and simply justification by works. This is saying that what Jesus did on the cross was less than satisfactory to God, and I have to add something to it. Or if you don't identify with that, how about this one? Something in my past that I deeply regret. I'd love to be able to reverse that or take it out of my past and get rid of it permanently. I've confessed it. As a matter of fact, I've confessed it I don't know how many times. And I've received the Lord's forgiveness, I've thought, I don't know how many times. And yet in my mind there's a thinking, this somehow or other disqualifies me a little bit with the Lord. Can you identify with that? Uh-huh. And yet, in Colossians 1 and something or other, we read about the basis of our qualifications. The mind's not what it used to be, folks. Giving thanks to the Father. Colossians 1 verse 12. Giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you. The Father has qualified you, past tense. Qualified you for what? To share in the inheritance in the saints of the kingdom, in the inheritance of the saints in the kingdom of light. Four. And the fours are very important in the Bible too. Four. He has rescued us. It's done. We've been transferred. He has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of his dear Son, of the Son he loves. We're in the kingdom. We don't have to do anything. We don't have to undo anything to get into the kingdom. It's done. It's on the basis of what Jesus did, not on the basis of what I do. And that is why I say we have to recognise our wrong thinking and correct it and keep on correcting it. Recognise when that little thought comes into my mind, oh, well, that should do me some good with God. Or, God's never really going to forgive me for what I did then. God won't forgive me for what I, as a Christian, mind you, as a Christian I did that. How could God possibly forgive me for that? My position with God depends wholly and solely on my faith in Jesus Christ, who loved me and gave himself for me, in order that my relationship with God would be 100% restored, There's a marvellous little story of Bishop Handley Mole picturing being carried to God in the arms of Jesus, and Jesus standing before God and saying, "This is Tom. I died for him." And God looking at his son and being 100% satisfied. That's all we need. Jesus taking me to God and saying, "This is Kath, I died for her." That's it. Anything that I can do or anything that I have done, totally irrelevant, as long as I've confessed the wrong things and received the forgiveness of God. So that's why Paul talks about confidence in the flesh. What is the flesh? If you take off the H and reverse the other letters, you end up with the right thing, self. Confidence in self. And Paul says, if anybody had reason for confidence in the flesh, I had. I know what I'm talking about on this matter, folks. I had the right background, the right education, the right one-eyed attitude to religion. I was most zealous for God. I killed I don't know how many Christians and destroyed their possessions for God's sake. And as far as the law was concerned, as for legalistic righteousness, absolutely faultless. And then came the Damascus Road. And Paul realised he'd got it all wrong. All those pluses were not only minuses, they were liabilities, they were garbage. The only thing that mattered from then on in Paul's life was to know him, the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. To gain him, and that word gain means slowly, slowly acquire. We don't know him like that. It's like cultivating a lifelong relationship with, but we've got to cultivate it. I'm not going to know God if I don't read the Bible, if I don't obey what the Bible says, if I don't pray, if I don't make time for him. You can always make time for him, folks. When I was in a one-doctor situation, busy, constantly on call, all the time, a very painful situation, and there we are, pain again, drove me to the end of my tether and beyond, and I realised that what I needed was the Lord himself. And so at that point I had to make time and space in my life for him on a regular basis. So I did it, 5 o'clock in the morning, set my alarm clock, had my cup of black coffee, had my hour with the Lord come what may, even if I'd just come home from the hospital at 4 o'clock. Why did I do that? I had to be legalistic with myself to begin with until I got through the chore barrier. We've got to get through the chore barrier to reach the point where it's no longer, if I miss my quiet time, it's not a matter of, oh dear, I've lost a few credit points with God today by not having my quiet time. It's not anything like that. It's saying, oh, I missed hearing what God wanted to say to me today. Totally different. Totally different attitude. So if we're to know him, if we're to have a lifelong preoccupation with knowing him, which is what the Christian life has to be all about, which is what living for Christ has to be all about, we have to give time to him. We've got to make time for him. And we've got to be people whose minds are set on having a mind full of God, being mindful of God, being conscious of God. That's what kept Jesus going. We've got 1 minute and we're just about there, folks, in a rushed kind of a way. 1 Peter 2 and something or other. 21. He's been talking about suffering. Peter's been talking about suffering. It's a great theme that comes through. It doesn't matter which of these great men of God you read. It's the same message coming through. Pain, growth, ministry. Pain, growth, ministry. If you want to have a ministry, you've got to grow, you've got to receive from the Lord. If you're going to receive from the Lord, you've got to be identified with Jesus in his death. Okay, talking about pain. To this, to suffering, you were called because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. wrong verse, back to verse 19. For it is commendable if a man bears up under the pain of unjust suffering. How can I do it? Because he is conscious of God. Because he is mindful of God. Because he has a mind full of God. How do I get a mind full of God? I've got to spend time with him. I've got to be preoccupied with him. I've got to be asking myself all the time, what would glorify God in this situation? And perhaps it's appropriate to finish on John 12 and 27 and 28, because Jesus himself gives us the model of living for him in response particularly to the hard things that happened to him. This is Jesus facing the cross. Verses 27 and 28. Jesus facing the cross. Now my heart is troubled, and what shall I say? And I find it enormously encouraging that Jesus said, and what shall I say? How am I going to cope with this? My heart is troubled. What am I going to say about this? What am I going to say to myself, to God about this? Shall I say, Father, save me from this hour? That's the human question. Shall I ask God to get me out of this awful, painful situation? No. It was for this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. See, he's our model. And whenever we're brave enough in our pain to ask, Father, how can your name be glorified in this? We can depend on sooner or later knowing that response. I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. And we can be 100% certain of that, because you see, in Philippians, when Paul is talking about the things that he wants to know. I know him. I want to know him. I want to know the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his of sharing his sufferings, becoming like him in his death. See, Jesus had to go to death, and death was followed by resurrection. But we don't have to do that. Before we face that death, we have the power of that resurrection. We have the fellowship of sharing his sufferings, and that means God's presence, Christ's presence with us in the pain. We can rely on that, however we may feel. And so, number four, even though I haven't arrived, I'm pressing on. Brothers, I don't consider myself yet to have taken hold of what Christ took hold of me for. He took hold of me to make me like himself. But one thing I do, forgetting what is behind, all those things that would drag me back, and straining towards what is ahead, I press on towards the goal to win the prize for which God has called me heavenward in Christ Jesus, namely, to be like his Son, to be like him.